Action. All right, so we have a real live, what we call them ISVs, I guess. You write software on various platforms.
Yep.
So tell us about yourself. What do you do, and what's your company all about?
All right, I'm Dan Johnson. I'm Chief Technology Officer for IFS, and IFS is a global enterprise applications company, which means we make... The easiest way to describe it, we do the same stuff with SAP or PeopleSoft and Oracle, those guys. We do everything from financials, HR, through manufacturing, logistics, product management, engineering, these types of business applications.
Excellent. And so I'd imagine you have a pretty complex architecture, infrastructure?
Well, we like to believe it's a little bit little bit simpler than perhaps R3 in terms of its structure. It's component-based, and it's based on an object-oriented design. So we do actually have the application broken down into discrete components with clear interfaces and stuff. So it's kind of almost a service-oriented application if you sort of accept the fact that it's kind of grouped, the core logic is grouped around business objects as opposed to services. But it's,
So could you explain that a little more, like for the people in the audience?
Well, essentially, if you sort of look at it from a business point of view, you sort of deal with different objects in your business, your customers, your orders, your invoices. These are typically called entities.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those, and if you look at an object-oriented design, you have the object itself and the functionality that operates on it grouped into one thing. That's kind of the core of an object. You have the instance variables and all the methods and so on. One thing, if you look at a typical service-oriented view, not from a technical point of view, but typically also weave in, you want to have it sort of broken down according to the business process.
Mm.
So you don't necessarily group functionality based on everything that's got something to do with a customer. You kind of group it, everything that's got something to do with, you know, shipping and sending, you know, creating an invoice, which means you need some functionality from the customer object, you need something from the invoice, you need something from the price list, you need something from the service agreements, and you combine that together. So it's a different way of grouping the functionality, essentially.
That's very cool.
But otherwise, it's still the same principle, you know, defined interface, a hidden implementation. So,
so these are objects that are that have properties that are composed of information from other objects.
Yep.
You take them on the fly, dynamically create them that contain this information. I mean, so let me, basically what I'm asking you is, you have a big database
that hosts all of this.
So what kind of database do you have?
We run on an Oracle database backend.
Cool.
We run a J2E middle tier. And then we run miscellaneous UIs. We have, you know, portal web HTML type UIs. We have a large degree of Win32 type UI. For a couple of our modules, we just gone over to .NET WinForms UI.
Ah, okay.
So how are you exposing all of this information to the different UIs? I mean, if you're going to be, if you've got a J2 EE middle tier and you've got the Oracle backend, then how are you actually bringing all this stuff back to the different clients? I mean, you mentioned that it was a sort of services oriented architecture, and people often confuse that with, you know, web services, you know, thinking that they're one and the same. But is that really how you're exposing the data? Or
it is, and it is. It's actually both. In terms of what we do, is we have, you know, we have the objects, we have the entities, and then we have the activity objects. Those are all in our business logic. Then we have something we call access providers, but these are basically the multi-channel protocol adapters. So we have a defined interface, we model an interface, we implement the logic behind that interface. That interface then, through our frameworks, automatically gets exposed as a web service. You do get a WSDL file for it.
Mm-hmm.
You also get, you know, we actually generate the C# wrapper clause for it. So if you're a .NET developer, mm-hmm. you will see a C# interface, and you will program towards that.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And then it's our framework code that sits behind and communicates with that service on our server. And then we do the same thing for a Java developer. For example, our PDA and telephone UIs are based on Java Micro Edition. So mm-hmm. then we have a Java-based client accessing the same service in the business logic.
So you have like some kind of middle tier. Well, you've got another utility that just sort of spits out
these different proxies. In AVO.NET, for example, you have a data provider that kind of talks to the backend data source. It's a similar design pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And we call them access providers, but it's essentially sort of a gateway thing. And then combined by actually generating, you know, a model for the interface for the service
mm-hmm.
In the native implementation. So based on what we have in our system, we will generate, you know, something that uses little gateway components. It's on the client side that talks to the service backend. We also do support, you know, SOAP interfaces
mm-hmm.
as well.
Wow.
But, you know, this is kind of what we do ourselves. When our client is talking to our server, we kind of do a homemade binary SOAP
mm-hmm.
type thing. Basically
for
performance reasons.
Performance.
If it's our client talking to our server, we don't need transformation. We don't need to use XML. We can have a more efficient format.
Sure.
But the server supports, you know, regular SOAP in parallel. So it will actually detect on the incoming HTTP request. Is this a SOAP request? I'll unmarshal it this way. Is this a request from an IFS client? And I'll unmarshal it this way.
That's really cool. That's almost, it sounds like you've almost kind of implemented your own version of WCF.
Yes. Know? Well, WCF, no, not quite. But
not quite, but in functionality, it sounds like you're doing a lot of similar things where it's sort of transport agnostic, and it's all about just passing the message, regardless of how it is that the messages get across. How'd you come up with this whole thing? I mean, a lot of devs, you know, kind of fit into this sort of like implementation level, sort of like, you know, somebody's given me a task and I'm going to code it out. I mean, where'd you get these ideas? I mean, are we talking about like textbook kind of stuff, or was this all experience? I mean, where did it all come from?
If you look at it from the architecture level, the ideas actually come from old IBM research around BPEL, I think it was called in those days as well. And then that kind of became BPEL for web services, which then became BPEL again. So if you look at how the architecture is defined, that's, you know, a big source of inspiration.
I'm sorry, what?
Business process execution language. The sort of standard to describe how you compose, you know, a business process based on different...
So it's like a meta language to describe how it is that everything's going to...
But that's been an inspiration for the architecture. Okay. But if you look at a technical design pattern, you know, what we have is a typical three-tier architecture. It's a database backend, there's a middle tier, there's a client tier. And then it's basically a factor, you know, of what our customers want. You know, we look to our customers, we see that we're still selling to customers where a lot of them run on Windows, but, you know, some don't. Some run on Unix. We have large customers, we have smaller customers. So we have that need to sort of let the customer choose the service side platform. So we support, you know, we support JBoss, we support WebSphere and Oracle on the service side, whereas on the client side, you know, everyone's running Windows. And we would like to see, you know, we think we have a benefit in building a richer experience for our customers, which is why we ended up with this combination of J2E on the server side while still using the .NET stuff on the client
side.
So
let's talk about that. What are you doing on the client side of the .NET stuff?
I mean, what we're doing right now is that we are building something we call edge applications, edge apps, which are, you know, we're trying to build a much more tailored user experience. If you look at a business application, you will find thousands and thousands of forms, you know, data entry type forms. Mm-hmm. You'll find lots of grid style type lists to sort of view the information. Then you find the old pie chart and the old bar chart. But that's kind of the type of interface you have. And we think there's a huge potential to provide people with a better tool. You know, imagine if your Outlook calendar didn't actually look like the Outlook calendar. It was just like a list of appointments in a grid. I mean, how easy would that be to support your task of planning your week? If it was, you wouldn't know when you have some time slot available. So you kind of need a design interface, and this applies also in business. Mm. You know, if you're responsible for operating a machine effectively, if you're trying to plan a production schedule, you know, these types of tasks, you do need a more design interface, and we think that can be a competitive advantage for us. And in order to build that, we need a productive environment where we can build these types of richer environments. Without that costing too much, you know, being too much hard work. And that was one of the factors in choosing to go with .NET technologies for this richer interface.
So wait a minute, you're saying that that's not just marketing hyperbole?
It's not
more
just
productive, more powerful,
To be honest, yes, it is. It is true. I mean, especially if you look at, if you're building a very basic, you know, form type stuff, it doesn't really matter that much. On the server side, you're programming business logic, you're manipulating data structures. Mm-hmm. You know, what programming language you use, what tooling you use, doesn't make a whole lot of a difference. However, you know, building a very rich interactive GUI is a complex task, and you know, that is one of the factors. We do believe that we achieve better productivity with Visual Studio and the .NET frameworks and these tools compared to other alternatives.
Had you tried doing this with any alternatives?
We haven't tried it on the same scale, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, we have experience. We have built, you know, we have used the other technologies, mm-hmm. you know, Java Swing, those types of things, for other things. So we have some experience with it. And, you know, based on that, we feel that this is more productive. Mm-hmm. But we haven't done it on the same scale. You know, we're sort of, right now we have a couple of these edge apps out. Mm-hmm. They're built this way. We have a few more coming.
Cool. So what did your developers think? I mean, do they like XAML? Do they like playing around in that space?
Not using XAML so much, yes. This is still mainly WinForms based.
Oh, it's
so
mainly WinForms.
We're just now starting to look at integrating you know, WPF stuff.
That's going to rock your world as far as, because that uses, you know, DirectX under the covers and all kinds of
cool stuff. Well, you got to think about, if you're doing enterprise apps that we are, our customers, you know, they're running Windows 2000, they're running Windows XP, that's what they're running at the moment. So it'll be, you know, a year or two yet before we can kind of require our customers to actually run XP Vista. You know, if we come with our business application to a large company, mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to get a large company just to replace like 100,000 desktops just because they want to be able to run our application. They have their plans and how they upgrade their desktops. And we kind of need to make sure that, you know, we can't require them to have more than what 90% of companies have out there. Very cool. It'll be a little while before we can really leverage that. But we're starting to look into it now from a, you know, starting perhaps to plan and build some of those features.
It sounds like you're doing a lot of non-MS development in there, you know, obviously. Yep. And that the MS stuff is really just, you know, on the client side. Just one thing I wanted to point out was that .NET 3.0, which is where all the WPF functionality lives, is actually going to function on XP as well.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, have you guys thought about doing any sort of a hosted scenario where you use ClickOns or anything like that so that you can still retain control over...
We do use ClickOns, not because of a hosted scenario. That's not the driver for us. I mean, mm-hmm. the driver for us is essentially, you know, want rich user experience.
Right, okay.
Still want web deployed. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the whole reason why, you know, us and many others have been doing a lot of HTML stuff is to get to an easy to manage and a cost efficient way of deploying the solution. So we saw that opportunity when Click was announced a few years ago. I mean, the web deployment in .NET 1.1, that kind of stunk. That was rather crap. But with Click Ones, we saw
that. Am I allowed to see that?
Sure. Having an
honest conversation. With Click Ones, we saw that opportunity and so to really get the combination. So we just now, only a few weeks ago, actually, we swapped over from kind of a homemade deployment scenario to leverage ClickOns for these applications.
So to the .NET 2.0 ClickOns.
Yep.
Yeah.
So now let's talk briefly about, I mean, because you guys, you know, you're just talking about the, you have a pretty complex heterogeneous system. What's it like to have to make decisions like, you know, I'm going to plug in WPF here, or maybe we'll check out WCF, or maybe we'll check out J2 something else, or some other... I guess what I'm trying to say is, how do you go about determining what piece you're going to put into the puzzle? What kind of research, what kind of, you know, implications is it going to have for the whole system? Does it play well in the whole system? That kind of stuff. As an architect, I mean, what kind of stuff are you going to do?
Where you have to start is you have to start by looking at what industries are we in, and, you know, what kind of customers do we have? That's the first point, and you've got to look at what kind of requirements do them. I mean, we can sort of push them a little bit. We can kind of say, well, you know, we'd like you to perhaps run a slightly newer version of this or something, but essentially we can't dictate their IT environment. So that's the first starting point. We need to look at what IT environment does our customers have in the industries where we sell. And that kind of sets you the framework. Then you need to look at, you know, what is it we want to achieve. You know, what is it that's really important? Is something that needs to be, that we're going to build, that's going to be stable over 15 years time frame? Is it something we're going to build for a 5-year time frame, and then we're probably looking at, you know, not using this at all or rebuilding it again? Those kind of factors, because they kind of decide how much you can use an out-of-the-box framework and how much you have to develop your own abstraction. Mm-hmm. If you look at things like data models, for example, you have, you know, ADO, ADO.NET. Now you get something called the Entity Data Model. You have something else in SharePoint. I can't even remember what it's called. On the Java side, you have JDBC data sets. You have Java Connector Architecture record sets. You have service data objects. There's a new sort of data set model every year, at least one. If you're going to build an application, you're going to write, you know, millions of lines of code that operate on the data, you really don't want to have to change your data model every 2 years. So you invest in actually developing your own kind of record set model at the bottom, and then you might sort of expose that as a ADO.NET record set as well. But those are the kind of decisions you have to make. You need to look at, you know, how long does it have to live? How much can I use an existing technology? How much do I sort of create my own wrappers around it? Or do I need to create like a, you know, if it's a Java, it'd be a POJO. If it's a C sharp, I know what it'd be, a PoC sharp. Just like a very basic core, relying just on the language as opposed to a whole bunch of frameworks.
That's interesting. I mean, but in the end, I mean, all technology evolves, right? I mean, you're not writing assembly code.
No.
But so, I mean, what I'm saying is the languages and tools evolve, and as they evolve, if you've created a situation where you have your own core, but then again, that might just actually be your IP and your asset to be your core kernel. if you will, that you were just talking about. This is the way we process data. Everything else that comes along we'll support by providing you interfaces to attach into it if you need an ADO.NET provider.
The core investment we make is kind of the model, the process structure, the data structures, how they're constructed, because that makes things easier, harder to build. So that's core intellectual property. The bulk investment is, of course, all the code that operates on this. And then how you interface with that. We can quite cheaply provide 15 different protocol adapters and gateways to interface from different frameworks and technologies, but it's very expensive for us to physically change millions of lines of code that actually perform validations, business logic, manipulate data structures, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, and that's this whole interop kind of buzzword that's going on now. I mean, that's exactly the problem, right? You have this asset. You don't throw it away. It's like what we do with our products, right? Like Vista is an evolution of Windows. So do we have everyone throw away all their applications so they can run on Vista and rewrite them all? You don't throw away assets. So I get what you're saying. That's cool. And what you guys are providing, we've enabled at least some interesting component for you to choose Microsoft technology, at least on the client. It doesn't seem like you've done it on the server side.
Again, that goes back to, with the customer base that we have, we'd be excluding ourselves from a big enough share of it that it doesn't work. But we do believe, by using cool and a really good experience on the client side, we can create a competitive advantage as well.
So. Cool. So what are some of your challenges with trying to adopt WPF?
WPF specifically?
Anything that requires the framework, right? Is that the typical problem that you have?
Challenges, not so big challenges, generally speaking. Of course, there's a little bit of a timing issue right now, in terms of we're coming here with an application that requires a .NET framework. It's not yet on every desktop. It's starting to get there. More and more XP desktops have it. Vista will have it. But that, of course, can be a bit of an obstacle. You need to explain to the customer that, to run our application, you're going to have to roll out this framework, and then they go, .NET framework, what is that? Is that secure? Can I trust that? So there's a little bit of that kind of issue, and that will disappear with time, basically.
Didn't this sort of used to be the same problem, though, when you were talking about, VB6 had a runtime, and even Visual C had a runtime as well, although it shipped with EOS, but a lot of people had to install the VB6 runtime.
Most people, if you have like an enterprise-type application, in the last 5 years, they've not actually been installing it. They've been installing it on a server, and they use, Citrix or Terminal Server. And they run it centralized.
This is a new problem.
Basically, large organizations, they don't roll out a runtime to thousands and thousands of desktops. They put it on a server. But again, what we're hoping to achieve here with ClickOnce and the deployment model is to get the best of both worlds, because there is a cost to that. Mm-hmm. You have your desktop sitting around there, plenty of CPU, then you have to have some, terminal servers sitting around as well. Mm-hmm. That's an additional cost. So, of course, it would be better and cheaper if you didn't need that. But in order not to need to have your terminal server running stuff, the deployment of a richer application needs to be as easy as the deployment of a straight, HTML JavaScript application.
Sure.
So it needs to get to that point. And I think with ClickOnce, it's extremely close. It's from a technical point of view, it's kind of, pretty much there. Mm-hmm. It's more a psychological thing. People React, the little dialogue says it's installing the application. It should say it's loading it. Mm-hmm. It's not actually installing. It's just loading it from the web server. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a psychological thing that
it's
doesn't...
It's actually a good idea.
It's a psychological thing, because most people associate browser-based, good, easy, locally installed, complicated. That's a sort of psychological thing. Technically, it's really no difference from a ClickOnce app and a web app. It's a file that gets loaded, cached, run. But psychologically, it's different if it's saying, I'm installing the application right now, or I'm loading it.
I've never heard it described as such. That's actually a really interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it is running in full trust, which is different than a web page.
You don't want to run in full trust. That's, again, one of those big no-nos. You don't want an application. That's why you want to do managed code and stuff, so that you can run it with, a trust policy.
Sure, you supply.
What we do is we educate our customers, and we provide a facility that when we take our application to the customer, the customer's IT department can sign the code with their certificate. And if they want to do a temporary, test certificate that they've just generated, they can do that. if they want to buy something from VeriSign and sort of sign it with another one, or if they want to set up a policy in the directory saying that trust everything that's signed by, you know, this IT department, they will have that flexibility, and that's generally a good thing.
Cool. And they could use the code access security policy management system.
But they, you know, this is one of the, getting back to the challenges, this is something there, you know, we're depending on essentially, you know, Microsoft educating organizations around the world about these things. Because it's kind of tough to be the first one. If we're the first application that uses code access security, that's kind of tough, because we get punished with the learning curve to educate the customers, IT guys, about what this is, how you deal with it, how you set up policies. So, of course, it would help us a lot if that becomes more commonplace. And, you know, if it's something everyone's familiar with, easy saving.
Absolutely. Well, I know they're doing, that team is actually doing some good work now with making it easier for people to understand policies. Because IT guys typically aren't developers.
Yeah.
So give them tools that actually go and modify these XML files, and that then makes it more reasonable to them. They can understand that when this application is running in this context, it can't harm the user. In other words, they're not going to, you know, we're not going to destroy their hard drive or get into your infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. That they are working on making it a lot easier by developing tools. When they're going to come out, I thought they had actually done it in 2005, but code access security has always been one of those
hard
problems.
Yeah, it's a tough issue. Yeah.
But I think sort of, you know, I think the process of having the customer sign the application is an easier one to understand. You know, they get the code from us, we're a supplier they trust, they know there's not going to be any viruses or anything bad in this code. They sign it with a certificate that's set up, at least, you know, within their domain, to be something that's trusted. And that means when the user click on it, they're just going to get this dialog saying, you want to run this application, it's been published by our own IT department, everything is good and nice, and off you go and you run it. So that's a fairly easy concept to understand.
That does sound like a good way to go. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's another good tip to have on the
on the
video here. Yeah, we're getting a lot of good stuff out of you.
Absolutely. Well, no, I mean, it's really nice to talk to, you know, someone in the real world that's not, you know, we live in the ivory tower. We, you know, it's nice. What I mean by that is just that we all, you know, I live at least, and you do as well, Rory.
Yeah.
I mean, everything we use is Microsoft, right? When I do development, I'm hitting a SQL Server, I'm using WCF, I'm using WP, I'm checking out all of our stuff, dog fooding it. In the real world, it's much more heterogeneous, so it's nice to see the way that you're using stuff and what the challenges are and what you like about it and don't like about it. Because Microsoft people watch these videos, so someone from the WPF team and WinForms team would listen to the feedback. Something to keep in mind.
Yeah, if you have something to say, then...
I think what's important to say is, you know, and I think we see evidence of it, but it is really important to guys like us to keep the interfaces open. You know, if you have a Microsoft client-side technology that talks to a Microsoft server, you know, if you can keep those interfaces open so that we could communicate with the server from a non-Microsoft client or vice versa, perhaps even have the client technology talking, you know, to a web service that we implement instead or something, those things are important. That really does help a lot. And it, you know, the same kind of story when you look into things like presence and workflow and these things, that it can be open. If we want to fire an event from our application that triggers a workflow and then the workflow foundation, you know, we want to have an open API, we can do that regardless of where our server is running or what technology is used. That is important. And I think, you know, at least we can see that happening a lot more these days.
We'll absolutely
keep on doing that.
You better believe it. I mean, WCF, as you were saying, it's all about open, I mean, it's, you know, and there's this whole open standards promise. I'm actually interviewing the lead people behind that today, or after this interview, so I'll make sure to talk to him about exactly what you're saying.
And then if you want to do more stuff that would help us even more, that's if you would to provide, if Microsoft would actually take the step to provide, you know, implementations for some of the technologies on the Java side. Yeah, the reverse happening. If you go to a company like Oracle or something, they're making a database. It's their database, but they will also make an ADO.NET driver for it, right? Because that's important for them, because there's a lot of developers on the .NET platform. If Microsoft could do the reverse thing, if they have their Active Directory, and then they make a JAS plugin, a Java Authentication Service plugin or login module for the J2E servers that actually authenticates against Active Directory, you know, that kind of thing, that would be good to see more of that as well, I think.
Excellent. Agreed.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
So, you know, any more questions, Rory? I mean, I'm stumbling around here.
No, actually, I feel pretty satisfied. Yeah. I mean, you got a, I mean, we got a chance to sort of, you know, get all this information out of you that I actually think was, you know, really interesting. Because I used to, I came from this world where, you know, I was an independent and things were totally, like Charles has been saying, totally heterogeneous, and that's the environment I'm really used to. And so getting to hear, you know, from somebody from the outside, from the secular world, as we call it, you know, it's fun, you know. A little thing I got from Chris, I was there.
Good.
You know, I stole that from Chris. I just got to give props to Chris. Yeah. But, yeah, no, it's actually really great stuff. And then you got a chance to give some feedback, so I'd say, yeah, you know, very good.
I mean, I think the only other thing would be nice to know would be a little bit more of the details of your system. But, you know, I realize that there's certain IP restrictions, but not code. But I really like, my feedback, I really like the way that you're packaging these objects with the way you've designed your system such that you have these sort of dynamic objects, what it sound like to me, that take information from various places and just spill them down as a encapsulated thing that I can program against in an understandable way. I just think that sounds like a cool architecture, regardless of what you actually have running in the background taking care of it. So let me ask you, how much, you guys have a lot of C++ IP, I would imagine.
Actually, not that much.
Really?
There is on the client side, but there's essentially no C++ on the server side.
Okay.
Well, there isn't. To be
it's all Java.
It's all Java.
It's all Java, and then there's some PL/SQL that runs in the Oracle database. That's mm-hmm. on the server side. And then the client side is some C++. There's, you know, since a while ago, a bunch of .NET stuff. Mm. There is some J2ME things for the telephones and the PDAs. There's miscellaneous, you know, other specialized interfaces.
Have you looked at the .NET Compact Framework for any PDA work?
No.
Oh, well, I mean...
Well.
That's something, no, that really is something that's worth looking at, just because the .NET Compact Framework is probably one of the most impressive technologies
again,
for
again, it kind of falls back to the industries where we're working.
One
of the bigger
devices.
Industries is service management, which is typically field technicians are out repairing stuff.
Sure.
And they either they have a laptop in the car, they might have a Windows CE or a Pocket mm-hmm. PC-based PDA, they might also have a Linux-based one, or mm-hmm. they might have a Nokia smartphone,
yeah.
which runs Symbian. So it's kind of... Back to being in that kind of industry, it's not a case like on the desktop where Microsoft has whatever 85 or 95% of the market. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you know, everyone's got 30%, and it's too big a bet to make.
You know,
if the majority of all our customers all of a sudden say we want to run on Nokia smartphones, we'll be in big trouble. So we need to keep our options open there. So
sure.
It's kind of a consequence of being in that particular industry.
So here's a question that I can completely understand if you don't want to answer this. You can lean over the table and smack me if you want to.
Yeah, that would be funny.
But this is that would be funny. Yeah. Illegal, but funny.
Yeah, no,
and it would hurt.
He's a customer.
He can hit me. So when you kind of tackle a huge project like this, I mean, you're always going to wind up learning something, right? And I mean, is there anything where you look back and you think, I kind of wish we had, you know, architected this particular aspect in a slightly different way, or, you know, for V.next, I would, if I had the chance and all the time and all the resources, I would redo it as such. I mean, is there anything that sticks out to you that you'd want to modify or that you'd want to change or do differently?
I think sort of the product we have, it's built from 95 onwards, mm-hmm. so there was no code before 95, and, you know, the architecture that... The first principles were set back then, the product was developed, the architect's been enhanced. The thing I think we've been missing, we've been generally quite good. We managed to change, you know, the web tier twice, the mobile tier three times, the reporting solutions twice over this, you know, 10-year period. So it's gone fairly well. But the one thing we have been missing is we're missing factory patterns in a few mm-hmm. places. For example, you know, when we have one object that's actually instantiating and talking to another object in the sort of storage tier, we don't have a factory pattern there, which means we have essentially a dependency from one object to another object
right.
without the possibility to, through a factory, replace the implementation or sort of replace mm-hmm. the actual implementation with the dispatcher that dispatches that call to something else. Mm-hmm. That is a little bit limiting it when you want to sort of, you know, transform the implementation or move some of the code elsewhere.
So you wish it were a little more loosely coupled than it is right now in some areas, essentially.
Especially the factory pattern enabled, mm-hmm. to sort of when you want to move part of the logic elsewhere, to be able to move it and replace the old stuff with, you know, something that redirects essentially mm-hmm. to the new stuff without actually needing to change all of the other objects that are interfacing with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is something that is a little bit limiting. Of course, you know, in the stuff we built in the last 5 years, that's completely covered in those factory patterns everywhere, but we still have some of that stuff around from before.
Legacy code.
Legacy
curse
code,
of yeah. legacy code. Well, I mean, Everybody's got some.
Yeah.
Finally, I have to know, where's your accent from?
My accent?
Yeah.
It's probably from everywhere. I'm natively Swedish.
Okay.
I'm married to an English woman.
Okay.
And I travel a bit, so I don't know. You tell me.
No, you probably think
I'm British, and British think I'm American.
No, I was thinking a little bit, definitely English.
Yeah.
Was coming out. Even some German, maybe. Little.
Yeah, there was something else behind there that we just... I couldn't quite... I could hear that you learned your English, you know, with an
English
accent.
I can probably speak with a very Swedish accent.
Of course. You look Swedish. Yeah. I mean, you got that going on. That was kind of clear.
Well, very good.
Excellent. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you.
All right.
Thanks for taking the time to...
You're welcome.
Come in here and randomly talk to the Channel 9 people. Very useful information.
Yeah.
And we appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys.